This episode of UK Low Carb Podcast is sponsored by Deliciously Guilt-Free. Enjoy the show.
Is that accurate or is that all wrong?
Behavioral psychology, this is how I view myself. Who knows how it's viewed by others, but yes, that is how I view myself.
I got a hit. Brilliant. You might have said, no, I'm a cold-hearted bastard. I don't care about anyone. No, but I think that's true, right? I get that feeling that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I've deluded myself. Who knows? You know, people
say Me too. But we believe it. And that's the main thing.
Hey everyone, welcome to UK Low Carb. I record these intros at home at night on the Thursday before it goes out. So I recorded this interview with Dr. Tro a few weeks ago, and now it's time to bring it to the world. And what a wonderful interview it is. It was really special. Before I get into that, let's just go through the introduction, which I forgot to do. So hello, welcome to UK Low Carb. My name is Dan Grief, and here we share individual stories so we can help build up the low carb community and spread the message about low carb around the world. Today's a really special episode because I'm talking to Dr. Tro. Now, the great privilege you have with running a podcast is that you get to meet people like Dr. Tro and just spend time talking with them, which is fantastic. What an opportunity that is. Whenever I do these interviews with, you know, people who are more well-known in the low-carb community, I always do it thinking about you and what would you want to ask him. So I hope I do a good job, and I hope I ask the questions that you want to ask him. If you have any more questions, maybe you can see if we can get more in the future. But I think this interview is really special. You're going to learn a lot about him, about his research, the things he's discovered, and also get a sense of the man. And the thing I've always picked up with Dr. Tro, and it was kind of very obvious to me by meeting him, is that he's someone with a really strong sense of fighting injustice, someone who stands out and uses his voice just to advocate for his patients. And I think that's really inspiring. You know, he's like a warrior out there on the front line, sometimes being attacked by people, certainly quite often a lone voice. And that comes across in this interview in buckets, which is really special. So I think you'll enjoy that. Now, before I get into that, I'm just going to share what I've been up to this week. So I've been making chocolate mainly. So if you don't know, my name is Dan Grief. I run Deliciously Guilt-Free as well, which is a sugar-free keto bakery and now also chocolate maker. And we've got new labels for our chocolate bars. That's being rebranded. It's going to become a separate brand to Deliciously Guilt-Free. And that's so we can put it into shops and make it a separate kind of business, really. But you can still buy them on the Deliciously Guilt-Free website. Don't worry. It's the same business and everything. It's just going to have a separate branding. And the exciting thing is that next week, Besma and I, my wife, are going to Liverpool. And we're going to go and see a new tempering machine, which would be really exciting because at the moment, I do all the tempering and it's, you know, quite slow. The machine basically works at, you know, room temperature in a hot bakery, which isn't ideal. And I can do 60 bars in a day. The new machine does 250 bars an hour, no, half an hour. So it's ridiculously fast. I mean, we won't go that speed because we have to make the chocolate first and that takes like 48 hours. So it's going to take a while to actually make, but the tempering will be a lot quicker, which will be amazing. If you can afford it, it's going to cost a lot of money, but it will make things more efficient, which will then make our chocolate bars even cheaper. And the exciting thing is, of course, we're sending bars now to America, to Canada, and we have sent some to Australia. And that's because they've got a long shelf life. They last at least 6 months. So we've been sending them out, which is really exciting. Anyway, the other thing that happened this week was that I was invited by Tracy to come and talk to the Keto Fitness Club community. If you don't know, that's run by Mark Brereton and Ella Brereton, his daughter. And it's a community of keto people who, you know, many of whom I'm sure are listening right now. So hello to everyone. But it's a really good conversation. And Tracy, Gemma and Sue were really, really lovely hosts. So thank you for giving me such a wonderful warm experience and just chatting about stories. It's nice to talk about my story a little bit. So thank you for that. Okay, everyone. So I'm going to hand over now to Dr. Tro. So I hope you enjoy this show. And if you have enjoyed it and you've not left a review before, please leave a review. It'd be lovely. That would make my day. Right, everyone, have a marvellous weekend. And I'll hand over now to Dr. Tro. Take care.
Well, what a great privilege it is for me, because in the low-carb space, there are a number of podcasts. And I'd say the one that has the most, you know, listeners around the world, which has the most gravitas, is that done by Dr. Tro, which is the Low Carb MD podcast. And he's here now. So welcome, Dr. Tro, to UK Low Carb.
Yeah, it's funny. I have so many patients who listen to your podcast, say good things. And I'm just happy to be here.
Fantastic. Well, you know what? It's a bit nerve-wracking trying to do a podcast with, like, podcast royalty. But, you know, we'll get the niceties out of the way and we'll get down to the mean stuff. No, I'm joking. I was going to ask the first question, if I can, Dr. Tro, and that is, since you've been doing your podcast, you know, and how many years have you been doing it for now?
4 years? Yeah,
we're 4 years.
4 years, yeah.
Okay, so in those 4 years, what are the top few things, maybe three things, that you've learned that you didn't know before you started?
Well, we had a great interview with Paul Thacker very recently, who's an investigative journalist, who basically has systematically demonstrated that there's a lot of corruption and fraud in the medical industry that, normally, like, we like to idealize doctors and scientists. We like to put them on this pedestal. They can never do anything wrong, you know, the ones that are working, the ones that are retired, you know, they can never do anything wrong, right? Or, you know, but what he showed is systematically, they are very biased. And there's a narrative, you know, frequently that these prominent scientists and pharmaceutical companies, he used the Freedom of Information Act to look into the emails of a lot of the people who did the dietary guidelines, the nutritional guidelines, you know, everything from vaccines to NIH directors. He did a Freedom of Information Act, right? And when you look at the conversations that these people are having, you know, for example, the one thing he sent me recently was, you know, some prominent, you know, national scientists have burner phones.
What? Like a drug dealer?
They have burner phones. Yeah.
And can I just say for the listeners now, I know that because I've watched crime programs on TV, okay? Yeah. I don't know what the local dealers are doing, but I believe that's what they do. So yeah. These doctors do the same. Wow.
So they have burner phones because when you take an NIH contract or an NIH grant, right, you are now open to the Freedom of Information Act. Everything is fair game.
Yeah.
So they have burner phones. So why would a doctor have a burner phone, right? Why would a scientist have a burner phone? And you can see the emails that he's brought out where they're saying, we have to suppress, you know, this narrative. We have to suppress that narrative. I didn't realize how, you know, you think that medicine and science is about evidence. What I think I found out in the last 4 years is it's not just evidence. There's politics, there's values, there's culture, there's a lot of things that go into how we, you know, how we tell people what to do, you know. And wow. It took me a long time to understand that it's not all evidence because we know that in nutrition, you go to the evidence. It's very clear. Head-to-head studies, low carb is better. Head-to-head studies, low carb is better. So we're used to seeing that the evidence doesn't match up with the generalized advice. And the generalized advice, you know, I'm pretty sure in the UK is you guys have the My Plate, you know?
Yeah, it's the version of your pyramid effect.
Right. Yeah, we have the My Plate too now. So the thing is how can the generalized advice be so different from the interventional data, from the evidence? And so you realize that, you know, there's different types of data out there that affects those, you know, those recommendations, but there's also people with different cultures, different value sets, different agendas. That's what I learned. It's complicated.
Well, I was going to ask you about this actually. So it's interesting it's come up at this point because, okay, this I think I'm a little bit conspiracy theory phobic, and I tend to be very. That's the last resort, you know, to think there's actually an underlying motive that's not honest. But of course, I'm not naive, so to not realize that's true. But what I find interesting is I always kind of believe, a bit like you were saying, that generally, and I think this probably is still true, generally most health practitioners have got the best interests of their patients at heart, and that generally most health practitioners are probably following a paradigm rather than really understanding. So there's a bit of ignorance there and well-meaning.
Yes, but, when you're talking about doctors.
But doctors, yeah, right, exactly, like the absolutely. Practitioner level. Yep. But then it's this level which is influencing the paradigm, generating it in the first place, maintaining it and sustaining it. That's the bit that you're saying there's a underhand element, which is, that's really quite worrying, isn't it? But it does make sense, though.
Well, here's the problem, right? So if you're going to advise somebody on what to do, how to do it, right, you have to understand the risks to your recommendation, right? Part of being a doctor is something called informed consent. So if I tell somebody to do a low carb diet and they have a history of kidney stones, I should tell them, hey guys, listen, for the first several weeks, okay, because when your kidney sees lower insulin and lower glucose, you're going to pee out some more electrolytes. We know that for like the first 2 or 3 weeks, right? We know this happens. It normalizes, doesn't persist. Right? Your kidney's going to leak out some calcium. It's going to leak out some sodium, right? So, hey, you should really drink water till your pee is clear if you have a history of kidney stones. If you have a history of gout, right? What do we tell them? We say, hey, look, it's not that meat, you know, causes gout. It's not that, in fact, actually fructose raises uric acid reliably, fructose, which is the sugar in fruit, right? So the thing is if you have gout, yes, when you go on a ketogenic diet, uric acid, which is the precipitating factor in gout, and ketones, they compete for the same spot to leave the kidney, right? To get urinated out. So okay. When you first start making ketones, it blocks some of the ability for the uric acid to be excreted. So your uric acid can be artificially inflated for a couple of weeks. It gets better.
Yeah, so things balance, so they regulate again.
Yeah, the body. So my job as a clinician is to know this, right, and to advise my patients, right? Now, the problem is most doctors, I don't think they go to the primary data. You know, they don't go, so they're, you know, I think you're right that they mean well. No, I don't think anybody went into medicine saying, you know, I'm going to ruin somebody's life by telling them to eat plants, you know, like an evil agenda. But
be a really bad sort of villain film, wouldn't it? With James Bond or a superhero. Yeah, exactly. Plant-based diet.
Yeah, I've been trying to get them to eat grasshoppers for years, you know. But the thing is that most doctors, right, they suffer from ignorance. And they can't be masters of everything, especially the doctors that people turn to, the GPs, the primary care doctors, the nurses, right? These are the people that everyday people are interacting with, right? They don't have the time. You know, I had to read 300 diet books, 4 diet textbooks, 4 books on obesity, and 3,000 articles to know what I'm talking about when I talk about nutrition. Right. I mean, this is an insurmountable task, right, for the average GP. I mean, Dr. David Unwin's in the UK, there are not a lot of people who are like him. Yeah. Right. That he is few. He is one of the rare people. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think for the most part, it's just a little bit of ignorance, you know, and we work these doctors to the bone, especially the last 3 years, you know. Just for me, like to stay on top of nutrition and stay on top of COVID, I've read over maybe 200 articles on COVID, of which there are maybe 2,000 or more. I have read, you know, all the clinical trials that came out for the new therapeutics, the monoclonal antibodies, the vaccines. I've read all the trial results that were published. I mean, I don't know how my colleagues do it. I have the luxury of having time to do it, you know, and an amazing wife who lets me read. But if I'm an average primary care doc, I don't have the time to do that.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I mean, my wife's a doctor, and but she's an oncologist. But a lot of her friends from university became GPs, and they all worked so hard because, like you say, they have such a massive workload to get through with COVID and all the rest of it. And of course, but then I also think, you know, if they could look at the primary sources, brilliant. but also they should be able to trust their guidelines, right? And this is something I know you've spoken a lot about, that the guidelines that Lily Nichols came on here, she was brilliant as well, and she was looking at the guidelines with regards to, like, you know, women with gestational diabetes, and she said all you had to do is open it up and look at it, and it's contradicting itself all over the place and making big assumptions. And you've found the same thing, right, in the States, and of course the States effectively shapes the rest of the world's, Western world's guidelines. So can you tell me a bit about what you've discovered there, and where is the disconnect in the guidelines and how they're written?
Yeah, so it depends on the guidelines you want to look at. We've tackled many of them. So if you look, for example, at diabetes guidelines, all right, blood sugar levels in diabetes, the ADA finally in 2019 said, you know what, lowering carbs may just be a way to treat diabetes, right? So there's some wiggle room, but the amount of evidence it took for them was just insane, right? I mean, we're talking about hundreds of trials it took for them to say maybe diabetes works. Now, if you look underneath it, they say, you know, literally they say lowering carbs is the most effective way to improve glycemia. Then they say, you know, choose from one of these four diets, DASH, Mediterranean, you know, plant-based and low carb, right? That in and of itself is a contradiction, right? So, you can't have plants and whole grains and more fruit and necessarily lower your carbs. Those are two competing themes. Now, the second thing that the ADA guideline says is we need to focus on calories and weight loss. So they first start out by saying, you know what, carbs may be something, pay attention to it. And then they say, pick from these four diets, right? And then they say, you know what, actually, it's mostly about weight loss and calories. So we took three patients in our clinic, okay? Our general advice is don't worry about calories, at least up front, okay? And their A1C was 12, and it came down to 6. And they didn't lose too much weight to get that change. They lost only 8 pounds. And the reason why I published this was because it was direct contrast to what the ADA says. There was no weight loss. Right. There was no significant weight loss, which they consider to be 5 pounds, 5%. There was no weight loss and there was no focus on calories. There was just intermittent fasting and eating low carb. And the A1C dropped from 12 to 6. So this is like not a thing for the ADA.
Do your patients know that they broke the guidelines, and what are they going to do about it? They're going to repent in some way and apologize to the guidelines for their cheeky bodies doing something a little bit, you know, out of the ordinary.
Well, look, they signed off on, you know, they have to agree to, you know, give their medical data. So they were all happy to participate in that. What was interesting about that study, what we showed was, you know, not just that they came off insulin and medications and were able to get to an A1C of 6. I know, do you guys use millimolars or A1C? I forget.
Millimoles. You know what? I'm not an expert in diabetes for sure, but my wife would know that. I can ask her later.
So A1C is the measure of the amount of hemoglobin. So hemoglobin is one, you know, basically the red cells, the blood cells in the body, and the amount of sugar that binds to it. So we can calculate that percentage.
And that's like over a quarter of the year or whatever. Isn't that the case? Yeah.
Because those cells live a quarter of the year. Their lifespan is a quarter of the year. So we check those levels. It's called an A1C. It's the, you know, amount of hemoglobin that's glycosylated, fancy way of saying sugar is bound to it. And if that number is high, it means your sugars have been very high. So theirs was double normal.
Yeah.
Right, which is, you know, if a doctor saw that, they'd say, you need to go on insulin, right? Yeah. And then what happened was it went back to normal by taking them off insulin, off of medications, just eating low carb and intermittent fasting, and they didn't even lose that much weight.
So this is really the whole cause and effect is on its head, isn't it? So the guidelines and the sort of standard dogma is the weight gain causes the high blood sugar or causes diabetes to happen. And in actual fact, you've proved completely the other way around. By just cutting the blood sugar, the weight was still there. So hang on a minute. maybe the weight gains do the blood sugar as well, right? Let's be radical here. But, you know, that's the thing, isn't it? The cause and the effect is so important to get the right way around. And I hear people say that all the time. I put on weight, so I got diabetes. I lost weight, so I reversed it. Well, hang on a minute. Maybe they're all part of the metabolic health syndrome and you literally saw your symptoms getting better across the board in different things other than diabetes. You also lost weight. And that's a huge difference, isn't it, in outlook?
Well, it is. So, but to give the current paradigm some credit, we know that weight loss improves glycemia, hands down. So we know it improves. So yes, you want to lose 50 pounds. Look, I was 350 pounds myself, right? If you were going to tell me, listen, you have to lose 150 pounds, right? And that's just going to take care of diabetes. Or how about you can lose 150 pounds over the next 3-4 years of your life, which is how long it took, right? And in the meantime, you can eat low carb to help you with your weight loss and get you out of diabetes, right? Yeah. As you lose weight, right? So here, that's just one of the guidelines. I mean, I can go on and on. The NLA, the National Lipid Association, says, you know, if your triglycerides are high, that you should not, it's contraindicated to do keto. They got together, the boys club of lipidologists, okay, they got together and they said, you know, old white men and in, you know, wearing white coats, right? Okay, they all got together and they said, you know what, we don't like that keto. The level of evidence was basically, you know, grade 3C, which is expert opinion, right? So expert opinion. So I was like, that's interesting. Okay.
So the status quo makers are being asked what they think about the status quo.
Bingo. Okay. So what I did was I published a study. We took people who had 800,000 triglycerides in a very monitored setting, very monitored, meaning we were checking their triglycerides in a very safe way. We looked into the literature. We knew that triglycerides are the most effective way to be reduced through a low-carb diet, right? So, and we put these patients in a low-carb diet. And we literally, week by week, watched their triglycerides drop from 1,000 to 150. So we published this, and we called out the National Lipid Association. We said, you need to be more accommodating. And we called out the ADA and we said, you need to be more accommodating, right? Because their guidelines, whether it's an explicit bias, or an agenda, an implicit bias, I don't know. All I know is it's biased and it's wrong.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I can't be the judge. I don't know if somebody, you know, there's somebody sitting down saying, you know, I'm going to make sure nobody ever does keto at the low, at the National Lipid Association. But that's literally what they're saying. Literally something that we know is universally approved with the low-carb diet. Low-carb diets are the most effective way to lower triglycerides, fasting triglycerides.
Which is, again, like, you don't hear that, do you? You hear that you eat fat, you have high. And that's the other thing as well, by the way. People separate fat and carbs out, but actually it's the combination that's kind of a really bad mix, isn't it? So we talk about going lower carb. And some people go higher fat, some just cut their carbs down and that's about it. But it's a combination of the two in the standard sort of Western diet. That is the issue, isn't it? So, you know, if they start saying, well, fat's not good for you, well, actually, it's a combination with fat and carbs that's the problem, right?
Yeah, so it depends on if you look at it from an obesity perspective and a weight loss perspective, fat and carbs are very obesogenic, okay? Yeah. Meaning like, take a plain potato. Right? Plain baked potato, you know, it hasn't been cooked. Nobody's going to sit there and chew on a plain baked
I'll
potato.
I'll leave that, yeah.
Even if it's a cooked baked potato, nothing on it, you don't really want so much. Now, make chips, make French fries, a loaded baked potato and what happened, meaning with sour cream, butter, and all these things, right? I don't know if you guys do that in the UK or if it's a uniquely American dish.
No, I used to, and that's why the state I am now. But we had them here too, yeah.
No, so now all of a sudden you're eating, right? So there's a reward potentiation in the brain that responds to carb-fat combinations. And people realize this, for example, what rice versus fried rice, right?
Yeah.
Spaghetti versus spaghetti and Alfredo sauce, right? Or like a pasta with Alfredo sauce. So this carb-fat combination, you know, who eats plain pasta with nothing on it? Nobody. Mac and cheese, everybody loves it. Or so, yeah, this carb-fat combination is uniquely triggering for your body and makes you eat more. But, you know, it makes you eat more, one, because of that food reward. It's like a dopamine rush. Your brain's like, this tastes good. This is great. Keep going. But it also makes you eat more at the subsequent meal. So when you have so there's new drugs used in obesity. They're called GLP-1 inhibitors. Have you heard of them?
No, I haven't heard of these.
Yeah, so they're like injections, right? They're an injection. They help you lose weight. And they work through a hormone called GLP. It's funny. Most doctors are like, listen, hormones have nothing to do with weight loss.
Yeah, it's calories. That's what you need to worry about.
Yeah, but take this drug.
An injection.
Yeah, take this injection. That's a hormone. So interestingly, this hormone, if you look at what are the nutritional ways to modulate this hormone GLP, which makes people full, which makes insulin more efficient, right? The ways to modulate this hormone is literally by not eating carbs and fat together. So when you have protein or when you have fat it gets to the intestine sees the carb and fat trigger and it releases a lot of GLP. And GLP, as it increases, your body becomes less hungry, more efficient at managing your blood glucose with less insulin. So it becomes, it's an insulin sensitizing hormone. It's called an incretin hormone and it's a gut hormone. If you have protein and fat alone, right, the GLP basically gets higher and higher. If you add a starch, right, if you add a starch to that, if you add a carbohydrate to that, the GLP that would have been released is not released at all.
Wow. So you have the same meal with literally meal. Just a few chips or fries at the end, you know, on the side. Yeah. No, but the same amount of calories and everything else. And yet suddenly this isn't, wow, that's incredible.
Correct. So here's the thing. There's a lot about nutrition that we don't know. There's a lot about nutrition. There's a new study today that came out, or this week that came out, that showed non-nutritive sweeteners. And look, I use sweeteners on occasion. I'm not saying, like, you know, we have monk fruit and we have, you know, sugar alcohols. And, you know, when we're making low-carb birthday cakes with almond flour and sweeteners, we use these on occasion. But it turns out, you know, the most common one, sucralose, the yellow packet, I don't know if it's yellow in the UK, but the yellow packet, it actually makes you more insulin resistant, right? Wow. And it has an effect on the microbiome. So I'm not saying don't use them because they're certainly better than sugar. What I'm saying is there's a lot about nutrition that's beyond calories. There's nothing to do with calories and that has, you know, pretty profound impacts on our body.
That's incredible. You know what? I think the calorie argument is kind of, as time goes on, it's getting harder and harder to fill the gaps, isn't it? It's kind of being left by itself in the middle. And there's all these questions that are unanswered. And I find so many people make the assumption that just a calorie is a calorie, so that's it. But then if you actually said to them, let's just break this down for a minute. Do you really think that 1,000 calories of steak is the same as 1,000 calories of broccoli? Then they'd know that's not true. They just know it. They know the volume wise it's not the case anyway, but they also know at a fundamental level that the impact that food has on your body is different. They just know it. And yet they still hold on to the calorie in, calorie out, which as time goes on, like I say, it seems so dated and just out of place in the world of nutrition now, but it's still the dogma.
Yeah, I think, you know, here's the thing. No other animal will count their calories, not anyone, right? So to manage their weight, a lot of their weight management is environmental, meaning the environment dictates what they have, the types of foods that are available, the seasonality, the scarcity, the availability, the amount of work needed to get that food, right? How frequently they eat. So if you look at any other animal, the environment is a regulator on their weight. Right. The problem is there's no like raccoon that sits there in front of the McDonald's garbage can and says, you know what, I should really calculate my, you know, calories before I go in here and go to town. Right. So, in fact, a really interesting study showed that raccoons are now getting diabetic. Right. We have raccoons that are getting diabetes. Wow. This was a study from 2019 out of Montreal, where they looked at urban raccoons versus suburban versus rural raccoons. And what they found was The suburban ones are pre-diabetic. The urban ones are diabetic.
Wow. So it's like you go from the countryside where they're absolutely fine, and the closer to the center, the more unhealthy they get.
Incredible. Interestingly, the veterinarians, who are a little bit better at understanding species-appropriate diets than we are, they said, you know, we believe that the diabetes epidemic in urban raccoons is due to access to garbage. And they said, what's in that garbage is our food waste. So literally the food we are eating, right, and we're putting in the garbage when it's left over, that's what's causing diabetes in raccoons. Now, I don't think that that raccoon needs to count its calories better. I don't think the advertisements are affecting the raccoon to eat more. I don't think that the raccoon needs to go on the treadmill.
I was going to say, maybe they're getting lazy, because that's the implication that we get as humans, right? That somehow we're feckless, lazy people who are cutting corners. We're not going to the gym as we should be. We're not running like we should be. And we're not eating more apples. So maybe the raccoons are just a bit lazy. Have you thought of that?
Look, the bottom line is that they need more injections. That's probably what
Exactly. That's exactly what it is.
We need to get them, and we need to offer them compassionate.
Get this raccoon a shake right now with low calories and get them drinking it through a straw. That's what you need to do there.
We need to cut their stomach, and we need to give them a bypass, because this is the way to manage their obesity epidemic. Look, the problem is when I brought this up politely at Obesity Week, you know, they sent me a lasting letter saying maybe you shouldn't come to these conferences. You know, when they, you know, these bigwigs get together and they say, you know, they have these, you know, very important Venn diagrams with what's the cause of obesity. And, you know, I politely raised my hand and I mentioned this 2019 study on raccoons' access to garbage being the cause of the diabetes and obesity epidemic.
So, shut up. Get him down, someone, please. Yeah, this Venn diagram, there's a massive Coca-Cola ring and you're not in it.
I think you said you don't like conspiracies, but...
It looks like I'm now hatching them all over the place.
I mean, look, the reality is I think it's not to say my colleagues aren't wrong. They're not wrong. They're right. Right. But that lens is so important to understand. You know, the causality is so important to understand.
For sure. I think that's it. And actually, this I was going to ask you about your own story now, because I was going to ask you, like, why did you found your podcast? And also, you know, how did you change your life? Because that is what I find really interesting. There's a common theme here with many of us. And that's the fact that you see it in yourself. And then quite often you then want to tell the world about it. But I think doctors have a particular other focus. And that's the fact that you can also have the empathy for other people who are in a similar situation as to maybe where you were. And I was going to ask, you know, what came first? Was it low carb changed your life, or did you learn about it in your practice like Dr. David Unwin?
No. I had to learn about it myself. My wife was like, hey, I want you to be alive. And I was 350 pounds. You know, David Unwin was maybe 170 on a good day when he's wet, you know, but, you know, I guess you guys do kilos, right?
We're Britain's weird. So
stones.
We do a bit of everything. We do stone and kilos. See how that works. We drink in pints, and we have our milk in pints, and we have our road in miles. But then at the same time, people measure themselves sometimes in feet and sometimes in meters, and it's a mess. It really is. We don't know if we're American or if we're European here. That's the problem. But anyway, sorry, you were saying.
Look, bottom line, like he is, David Unwin is just an amazing, amazing man. It's funny, my wife listens to him and is like, she's like, can't you just be a little bit more like him? You know? I was 350 pounds. I was suffering. I trained in the Yale system. I was chief resident. You know, I was smart. I was disciplined, right? And I didn't know how to address eating. I didn't know how to eat, right? And I tried to do what the common message was, right? Like it's just like the pandemic. You know, everybody comes around and people say, wear a mask. You wear a mask. You just do what you think is the right thing to do. You do it. You're like, you know, everybody's doing this thing. Must be the right way of doing it, right? So you go do it. And then I'm doing it. I'm trying to count calories. But then, you know, I'm having, my hunger is through the roof. You know, I try to limit my portions, but I'm just starving.
And this is advice you're giving your patients too, which makes it particularly challenging, I think, because, you know, an unhealthy doctor is saying to their patients, do this, and they know when they do it themselves that they're probably struggling to follow their own advice.
Well, I'm deferring, really. I'm saying, look, we all need to do this, right? All need to do this. We all need to do this, and we need to get better, and you should go see the dietitian. And then nobody ever lost weight with the dietitian. Nobody ever reversed their diabetes with the dietitian. And I think the messaging there is probably the problem. So the thing is I was suffering. And my wife was like, well, you're a smart guy. Go figure this out. And, you know, I was like, okay, I can figure this out. You know, and she's like, well, what would you do if it was any other medical issue? I told her I'd go read about it. You know, I'd go read about it. So I went and read about it. I mean, like, it wasn't like a, you know, I had never had a steak. I didn't cook eggs in the morning. You know, if anything, I had a vegan and vegetarian stint as a young adult. Right. So you go to the medical literature and then you read it. It's kind of like, you know, you dig just a little bit deeper, like Paul Thacker's doing. And then you just find out everything is not exactly what they said. Like every interventional study, low carb versus low fat, low carb does better. Not like hugely better, but always better.
But significant that it's always the same, right? I mean, that stands out, no end.
Exactly. Yeah. You see pattern again and again and again. Even the meta-analysis is like, hey, look, you know, low carb does better by a couple pounds. You know, I'm like, just wait a second. Like, you know, the average person in this modern environment, when they even attempt a low carb diet, it does better. If this was a diabetes drug, what would I pick? If this was a drug for pneumonia, what would I pick? I'd pick the antibiotic that was better than the other one. I mean, that's literally where I started. I was like, I don't have a horse. I just noticed the bias from the general message was discordant from the primary data.
Right.
So, and that's when I'm like, oh fuck. So shit, am I allowed to do that?
We have.
That's where I was like, oh shit. Like what is going on here? How is the standard messaging and all the guidelines from the American Cancer Society, the AMA, the AHA, the ADA at the time, how is it so different? Right. And so, you know, I entertained the conspiracy theories, but at that time I wasn't entertaining them. I was just like, I just need to lose weight, you know? And their guidelines, if you look, they buy themselves these intellectual outs, like have whole grains, have fruits, have this, have that, have 9 servings of whole grains, you know, the,
9 a day. Yeah. It's really,
yeah. Healthy, have 6 servings of fruit. Like, here's the thing, right? They buy themselves an out. They're like, well, at the end of the day, you have to balance your calories. So what they're saying is we're going to, you know, maintain the obesogenic environment, right? We're going to maintain a diet that's high in carbs. Okay. We know it's going to make more people hungry. Let's shift the agenda onto them. You know, it's like taking these raccoons and saying the ones that are in the urban areas, it's your fault.
Yeah.
You're diabetic. No, they were fed, you know, high carb processed foods. So that's where my journey started. And then I lost, you know, 70 pounds the first year, 50 pounds the next year, 25 pounds the year after that. And
fantastic. You know, and that change is noticeable to your colleagues and to your family and also your patients as well, I suppose. So they must look at you and start going, what's he doing? I want the same. Did you have people asking you for advice and tips?
You know, I got to be honest with you. Okay.
Well, here we go. Exclusive.
Yeah, go on. I gotta be honest with you. I couldn't keep practicing in the same way.
Yeah.
You know, to really affect people's behavior, which is what I wanted to do, right? Like in the way, you know, I knew how people were trapped. You know, the messages they got from their doctors, the messages they got from their, you know, families, the messages from the government, right? I knew that they couldn't it's very hard for somebody. It's very easy for me. You know, I've always been independent thinking. I go to the primary literature. I question everything. You know, I'm the conspiracy guy, you know? So yeah. It's very easy for me to change my nutritional paradigm against a profound amount of advice. It's easy for me to do that. To ask that of my patients would be, you know, in 10 minutes. It's not like I'm amazed how Unwin can do it. You know, I don't know how he can do it. He probably spends a lot more time than most GPs. But so I knew that I had to get out of the American insurance-based see a patient 7 minutes type of setting.
And well, I think that's really, really important point you raised there. So I'm really into behavioral psychology, and I've read a book recently called Alchemy by Rory Sutherland. Now, he's writing it primarily for a kind of marketing audience, but he actually went through and he looked at history and he said, if you follow the status quo in anything, even if you don't really know if it's true or not, there's a lot less chance you're going to lose your job. There's a lot less chance you'll be ridiculed. And there's a lot less chance that you're going to humiliate yourself, because actually that's what most people think already. You're quite safe. You're playing it safe. He said you might not even know that you're doing that, but actually from an evolutionary point of view, as tribes, we probably have had a sense of follow the status quo because it will keep you safe in numbers. He said, but to be a radical and to question the status quo is really quite scary, because you could actually be wrong. And if you are wrong, then you'll be criticized more for being wrong if you follow the status quo, because everyone did it anyway. And even if you're right, you still have to then question, like, basically the theory of, like, all the greats above you have gone before you. And that means you actually then can have this issue whereby people hate you because they liked those people and they liked their ideas. And so you to stand out is really hard. And if you look at Semmelweis, if you look at, you know, through history, I used to be a history teacher, so I teach history of medicine through time. And you see these reformers that come along, and in politics and in lots of different fields, and they question the status quo, and they're hated, and they might even never be recognized in their own lifetime, like Semmelweis wasn't. And yet it's only afterwards, which is really cruel, right, that we look back and go, ah, he had the right answer. It's just that everyone hated him for it. And that's a scary position to be in. So I completely can empathize where you're coming from on that.
Yeah, there's no way for the average person, you know, it's kind of like the Milgram experiments. There's no way for the average person.
Oh, I love
person.
Those, yeah.
You know, there's really, it's hard. 80% of people will just do what's told to them, you know, even if it's harming themselves or somebody else. So I lose weight. I have this new insight. I'm going, you know, reading, interviewing, you know, on the podcast, you know, hundreds of luminary scientists. And, you know, once you go that far into the knowledge base, you know that it's agenda and Milgram experiments at this point. Like I have no, it's not a conspiracy theory to me. You know, there's no, you know, this is billion-dollar interests, you know, it's like big tobacco, right? It's like big tobacco. It took, even when they had congressional hearings, you know, the CEOs just 20 years ago were sitting in front of Congress saying cigarettes are not addictive. You know, like uniformly all seven major big tobacco companies. Right. And this is like despite 30 years of data showing that they're crooks, but it's a $1 billion industry, you know, multi-billion dollar industry. And so they have scientists, they have doctors. You know, how do they have all these people?
And they also have politicians.
They have politicians, right?
Yeah.
So it's not a nefarious, there's no like, you know, it's not nefarious. This isn't conspiracy. This is real life.
Yeah.
What did those food companies all do 20 years ago when they were, you know, forced to break up? They had settlements. What did they do? You know, they had the money to buy processed food companies. So all of the addiction peddling companies bought. Why would they buy processed food companies? Just think about it. It's like the next, you know, frontier for them.
The next addiction. And actually, isn't it like one of the greatest tricks to play is to say that food addiction isn't even real? Because then you don't have to say you're making food addictive things or addictive products for us to eat, but rather that doesn't even exist anyway. Food addiction's not real. So what are you talking about, guys? It's the ultimate kind of like smoke and mirrors, I'd say.
Well, look, the major issue right now, okay, the major issue is that food addiction is not real because you need food to survive. Okay, so this is a problem, right? And this second problem is, food addiction by the scientific community, I should say. I should put a quotes there. It's not real because, you know, but every person knows it's real. And it fits the DSM criteria very nicely for addictions, for substance abuse. So the bottom line is there are a lot of interests, okay? There are a lot of people who just want to keep going. There's, you know, we know human psychology is 80% of people will do what they're told. Doctors are the same, right? Doctors have been doing what they're told in their training all the way up through 10 years of their journey to being a doctor. They've been told what to do, right? And so they're probably even more susceptible to be influenced, right? I mean, and so this isn't conspiracy. It's just a terrible setup for people who want to make real behavior change and get healthy by eating low carb, right? It's just a terrible setup. So yeah, I've been doing this for 5 years in telemedicine, helping people understand how to make behavior change possible. And it's not easy. You know, it's not easy. It's very easy for some people. You know, for me, it was easy. I'm a doctor. I have an income. I have a beautiful wife that takes care of my 3 kids. You know, she's an attorney also. Like, I'm well off. It's easy for me. Right. And I have the knowledge set to question everybody. Right. But, you know, the average person doesn't have that. So,
well, the thing I'd have, if I can reflect on you for a moment, from seeing your things on YouTube, from, you know, listening to your podcast, I could be completely wrong, but I get the feeling that you're the sort of person who is incredibly empathetic and also has a very strong sense of right and wrong and justice and gets pretty angry about injustice. And the reason I say that is because you can be quite forthright and you're ready for a fight if needs be. And I think I've seen that on Twitter. You're out there fighting for what you believe in. But it comes from a really empathetic, caring place, because you can see how most people who, like you said, if doctors don't have time and, you know, resource to look into this stuff, certainly patients don't either. And that you are standing up on their side to say, well, I've got the ability to do this and this is who I am. And you're using that part of yourself to really stand up for people's health.
Yeah.
Is that accurate, or is that all wrong?
Behavioral psychology, this is how I view myself. Who knows how it's viewed by others, but yes, that is how I view myself.
I got a hit. Brilliant. You might have said, no, I'm a cold-hearted bastard. I don't care about anyone. No, but I think that's true, right? I get that feeling that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I've deluded myself. Who knows? You know, people
say me too. But we believe it, and that's the main thing. But I think that's really important. I think you need people to stand up. If you've got a voice and you're able to use it, then that is your skill, your talent, then use it. And if you've got the ability to learn about these things to help people, then you can't not. And I think that's interesting. I sometimes wonder, actually, I was thinking about this before this podcast, where would you be if you hadn't learned about low carb and high carb diets and you know, the weight gain journey you've been on? If that hadn't have happened, where would you be right now? And I suspect you'd be fighting for a cause, but I don't think you'd have your heart in it as much as this one, because this is so black and white and about justice.
I tell you, you know, I see lots of causes that I fight for, but, you know, then you get into that introspective thing, or, you know, am I fighting for enough? You know, am I hypocritical for not fighting for, you know, Ukraine? Am I hypocritical for not fighting for, you know, transgender rights? Or am I hypocritical for, you know, so, you know, I have a lot of introspection on, you know, ultimately, my voice isn't the right voice for Ukraine. My voice isn't the right voice for transgender rights. I'm empathetic to those. You know, my voice is right for, you know, this medical system is terrible. My voice is right for this nutritional paradigm is wrong. You know, my voice is probably right for, you know, authoritarianism has no place in medicine. You know, that's what my voice is right for.
Or anywhere, to be fair. I think authoritarianism is bad wherever it forms its head.
I mean, there's some people who don't think that, right? There's some, so yeah. I may agree, but there's some people who are like, most doctors think We need to tell people what to do, and they need to do what we say.
Yeah.
Right. So they can be healthy. It's kind of like a rancher with cattle. You know, guys, you just got to follow in line and follow the, you know, that's the, you know, that's the kind of way they view things. And that's most doctors. So most doctors are authoritarians.
I suppose also they probably follow the easiest path and avoid the friction, which is a very human thing, right? You know, most of us are like that in lots of parts of our life. I think it's really important that you're standing there saying, hang on a minute, guys, maybe the easy path is easy for a reason. It's not the right path. And actually, it's okay to question that. So, yeah, but I just want to say before we go any further, like, thank you for what you do, because I think there's, you know, doctors standing up and saying this stuff is so important. And I think it's where a lot of change is going to happen, because, you know, a good doctor in their area is actually a teacher as well, aren't they? And they educate the community and they help the community. And this, you know, I've actually moved recently, but the doctor I was at previously, I've been at for a few years, and they know everyone in this part of my town, Cambridge, where we live. They know all the families, they know their stories, and they are educators, and it changes lives, the impact that doctors can have. So thank you for doing that.
Yeah, look, I have to actually pretty soon go on and make more impact on my patients' lives. But I'll tell you this, Dan. I got a book day to day. But it's not all, you know, fun and games. Like, you know, social media has been kind to me in terms of the follower and the viewership, and the podcast has 10 million views or whatever. And, you know, we have an app with, you know, 3,000 people on it. So the people are resonating with me, but, you know, my research is not well received. You know, when I publish this work, it's viewed as, you know, my colleagues. I was asked to speak at a very prominent conference, and I had people specifically ask for me not to speak, right? Not to speak. We will not come if he speaks.
Wow.
Right? So the amount of bias out there, you know, like I said several years ago, I got an email from, you know, Obesity Week, the, you know, the Obesity Society saying, you can leave the conference, you know. You're absolutely right. You know, you mentioned the, before we came on the air, the interview with Lane Norton. You know, he represents the dogmatic kind of energy model that is rampant in, you know, sports nutrition, personal trainers, physical therapy, and doctors right now. And they're so hubris in their mindset, right, that they can't understand the that a different way is needed. I mean, it's like we have failed the last 50 years, and we've known about calories for the last 50 years. The knowledge of calories, the knowledge of counting calories, tracking them, there's more apps now than there ever was. I'm sorry, while it may be true that calories matter, right, they don't matter in terms of a behavior change tool, right? They don't matter at all in terms of affecting the obesity epidemic or changing lives. Now, does the idea of being mindful of what you eat and taking note of it help? Maybe. Maybe a few people. Not many, but a few.
Yeah.
Is the idea of being diligent about seeing the amounts and the portions that you are eating and thinking about that, does that help? Yeah, it probably does help a little bit, not much, right? So there are, you know, there is a way to look at it to support these people who I disagree with fundamentally. And there's things that I can take from them and learn. But when you can't admit the abject failure of the calorie model is, there's a problem. Like, we have 50% of America is obese. You failed.
But like, can I just say what they do very quickly? And by the way, how much time do you have? I don't want to eat into your time here.
I'm like, we went over. I know I was late. So, yeah, but we're coming on it.
5 minutes is okay. Yeah. Is that okay?
Okay.
Can I just say there's something that was very interesting in that debate. And if people don't know this, then go on YouTube and look it up. So Dr. Lane Norton and Troy were debating this, and Dave Feldman was the chair, wasn't he? And what was interesting is he did what I've seen a lot of people do in that situation. They kind of blitz you with study after study after study. I saw Nina Teicholz in a debate do the same thing, and I gave the same advice to her. And it was like, they do that approach, even though, look around the corner, the evidence of how healthy the Western world is right now and how healthy our raccoons are right now is that we're failing all over the place. And yet the evidence they're suggesting is fine. And actually, you just have to question the premise of the evidence. And that's what you did, right, by saying this is meta data or meta analysis. And that is actually, firstly, is secondary source, look at other studies, cherry picking. And it's also funded by these big bodies. And you have to ask, if they're funding it, are they hoping to get a certain result? And unfortunately, human nature suggests they probably are. And I thought, you know, that's what they always do. They come out with just all these studies that contradict what we see in reality. And you're like, come on, guys, reality over here, what's going on? And this study's not even that accurate. And I thought you did a great job on that.
Yeah, Simon Piper, you know, look, these are people who are literally paid off by Coca-Cola. You know, literally paid off by Coca-Cola, right? Whether they're a useful idiot or malicious, I don't know, right? So, and you can look at the way they designed a trial. I mean, it's literally set up to fail. You can set the exclusion criteria. Like, I want to look at low carb. I want to take out all the morbidly, you know, class 3 obesity. I want to not focus on anybody with type 2 diabetes. You have to be between a BMI of 17 and 27, and you have to be 20 years old, right? And now we're going to do a meta-analysis on low carb. Well, look, it doesn't matter. They can eat whatever they want, right? Like, so it's kind of like they set it up through these inclusion exclusion criteria. And you have to, if you don't question pharmaceutical companies, question people, you know, population-based study, if you're not able to look at trial design and question, well, what is the agenda here, right? Remember, there's a person who's designing that trial. There's somebody who's saying, I want an outcome or I want a test hypothesis. Right. So, and they are getting money from somebody who's wants an outcome. So if I wanted to make low carb look bad, I'd do exactly this: 25 and under, lean, right? You know, athletic and exercise regularly, has no mental health issues, right? No family history of diabetes. Yeah.
I wonder what the result might be. Let's see.
Yeah, exactly. So look, we're doing a meta-analysis. So the general population, you know, won't benefit, right? So like, this is what they do. Well, like, what about the opposite? Take the severely obese, the diabetic, the, you know, family history of diabetes, BMI of 50, you know, A1C of 12, right? So if you know how they're gaming it, you can game it the other way.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, but it takes this kind of mindset. If you look at the meta-analysis, that's why I feel bad for my colleagues. You look at this meta-analysis, you're like, well, the meta-analysis shows, you know, that everything's the same.
Yeah.
Can
I just say on that one, by the way, which is really interesting, because actually Dr. Norton did say that, you know, it's not about funding and that's irrelevant who funds the studies. And then he contradicted himself and said that Finney and Volek gain massively from low carb financially. And I was like, whoa, hang on a minute. What's going on here? You know, like, suddenly you can't question the funding from a massive corporation or anything, but then you can use the same argument against these two guys who are scientists. And yeah, it's just it's an interesting debate to be had. And, you know, I think that as time goes on, these will age badly, because all of that stuff is going to be by the wayside, right? So it's only a matter of time now.
Look, I think that I think it'll be a long time. You know, it took 30 years to topple big tobacco, so it'll be a 20 or 30 year fight, in my opinion. If you look at other industries, and you know, there's so much money, so much power, influence, you know, legacy power from big tobacco, it's not going to be easy.
Well, Dr. Tro, with you on the front line, I think it's, you know, we're getting there gradually. And I hope that I don't want to end on a sad note, but I just want to say, for all the people that you have helped and for anyone listening to this whose lives have been changed by Dr. Tro and your podcast, you know, a massive thank you on behalf of all of us. And thank you so much for joining me today on UK Low Carb.
Thanks for having me.